This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
If you heard a racist comment on the sidelines at your kid's soccer match, would you say anything? If a coach just brushes off a racist joke or so-called accidental name-calling on the footy field, does that matter? And if you had to really ask yourself, is my local sports club racist? Could you, hand on heart, say no? And do presidents, coaches, captains, umpires, refs, parents and players, do they actually need help and guidelines, maybe templates, to ensure that your club is safe, that it is welcoming and that it isn't racist? Well, something like that has just been launched. It's just been released and you're going to learn about how you can access it and how it was created in just a moment. And also coming up this hour, what did you learn at kindy? What did you learn at kindergarten? And why is kinder important? Is it just finger painting, sliced up fruit and lunchtime naps? Not that there's anything wrong with that. I'm down with that. But is it more than that?
On 774 ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Rochelle Hunt.
So what does racism in local and junior sport really look like? What does it sound like? You might think that your club isn't racist, but then racism always isn't obvious. It's that joke that goes unchecked. It's the comment that just get brushed off. Well, there is a new campaign, a new toolkit, so to speak, that is being launched today to help junior sports club deal with racism. This is a practical playbook and it will potentially help you and your club. It's being launched by Vic Health. It's called Set the Standard. And a part of the team behind this new playbook is Yorta Yortaman and Vic Health Chair Ian Hamm. Ian, first things first, how common, how problematic is racism in junior sport?
Good morning, Rochelle. So part of the data that's been pulled together to base this on, it's unfortunately, racism, and I think it's relevant to say we live in more heightened times around race and cultural issues than we have for some time. So, to be honest, I'm Aboriginal. We live in the post-referendum era. There are other things going on in the world, and they show up in the little things where people live, and a lot of that can be in community sport. There's data that shows that 56% of First Nations people have experienced racism in the past 12 months. One in three people participating in sport at the local level. So it's not just junior sport, it's all active sport levels, but at the community level. So that's just ordinary, the ordinary punters, as I call them, yeah. You know, playing their weekend games of sport, are experiencing racism. So regrettably, it is much more prevalent than people like to think it is.
I could imagine that there would be a lot of people, whether they're a parent on the sidelines or maybe you're the president of a local tennis club or footy club or netball or whatever it may be, you're involved in some way, would say, absolutely not. Our club isn't racist. But then things may slip through. Like I said at the beginning, it's the joke that goes unchecked. It's the comment that doesn't get called out. Would there be a lot of people and clubs that don't realise that they're racist?
And you're absolutely right to pick that up. That's where the majority of this happens, or that's the majority of the origin of this. Clubs per se, you'd be hard pressed to say a club, everyone in it, to its bone, to its core, everything it does is racist. Those type of things are very rare. What happens though is there are individuals who are in clubs, or there are people who come along to support a player at a club who may be somebody who unleashes with comments, who feels that they have the right, or in some weird way feel like they're supporting the team's efforts by having a crack at somebody from another team on the basis of their race. That's where this is most common. That's the stuff that that which we walk by, we approve. That's the most common form of this.
I know over the years I've spoken with a behavioural scientist at Monash, Eric Dennison, looking at homophobia in sport and looking at what makes the most significant change. And a lot of his work goes back to the coaches, and when a coach actually calls it out and when a coach makes change and they involve the captain of the club as well. With the research that you've done, and I guess the handbook almost that's being created here by VicHealth, who has the most significant influence? Are coaches important here?
Yeah, look, there's three levels of leadership in a club, in just an ordinary local setting, that have the most influence. It's the president or the chair of the club. It's the senior coach, or actually coaches of all the teams. They have a responsibility. And you'll often find the team captain also has a responsibility as well, or is seen as a leader who can do something to address and set out the expectations that they have, not only as the person responsible for the club, the team or the group, but also their expectations as a person. Enormously influential. I'd done some work on this previously in the late 90s with the then Footscray District Football League, which is now the Western Football Netball League, covering the western suburbs of Melbourne. And it was not only talking to all the players and so forth, but really looking to the leadership of the presidents, the club captains and the coaches to set out their expectations for the people who played at the clubs, the people who come along and support clubs, the people who want to participate in a range of different functions. Here's the standard we set for our club because it reflects on our community as a whole.
Yorta Yorterman and VicHealth Chair Ian Hamm is with you, part of the VicHealth team that has been working on this new, I guess, set of guidelines, programs, a helpful set of standards. It's called Set the Standard, and it will be accessible for people to be able to look at, to download and to use. This message, and it says, people who say their club or their workplace or their team isn't racist are people who aren't affected by racism. Ian, I remember one initiative that was called out, or that was an idea over the years when we've spoken about harmful language in sport, was giving some more power to umpires and to refs. And one idea was just to stop the play. And if something is heard, if an umpire hears something, they stop the play and they discuss it there and then. That it's not waited to then be reported. It's not there's no time that sort of goes past where somebody maybe then thinks, oh, maybe that comment wasn't as bad as what I initially thought. You know, that time sometimes can dull the impact of what is said. What about ideas like that? I mean, in these guidelines that are being released today, are there tangible ideas of what you can do right at the moment when you hear something and when you want to call it out?
Yeah, look, and it happens in a range of different places, Rochelle. So I think that's important to talk about this. So if you're on the sidelines of a game and you hear somebody else, saying something during the game, so another spectator, you can do something about it there and then by just saying, hey, mate, that's not on, you know, pull your head in or something like that. If you're actually playing in a game, and I think the idea of umpires stopping a game to work it through, that would be enormously difficult to do, but quite often it's so obviously clear that there is nothing subtle about it. So it could be an option that the leagues look to introduce, for example, where something is said by a player to another player that's quite clearly racist, and everyone's heard it. It's just a free kick. It's a penalty to the. It's a penalty against the team. Nothing sharpens
the attention like that.
Of the player and the coaches.
Yeah,
have given away a free kick.
Has that done anywhere?
There are codes, I believe some of the local football clubs, local football codes may have done something like that. Certainly I know umpires are aware of it. I think trying to resolve it during play could prove difficult, but then there must always be avenues to take it up later.
If you look at how rules have changed, well. If you say something or touch an umpire, for example, you know, that rule has changed over the years, so it could work.
Oh, absolutely, it could work. And it gets the message clear really quickly and in a none too subtle way. I mean, to be blunt about it, it's dealing with it by throwing a brick, but that's okay. That kind of stops people just doing it, you know, which will cost your team a penalty, be it, well, in Australian rules football, it's a free kick. In netball, it could be a throw or a shot at goal. It could be a range of different things relevant to that code. But very, very quickly and very clearly, players will know exactly that is not on.
And I guess that would then lead to changing of the so-called, well, it was an accident, it was a habit, or it's just a word or a term that we use. There was nothing meant by it. It would change that poor pattern of behaviour and language.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely, because that excuse of I didn't mean it, or it's just
words.
That as somebody who was subjected to that every game of team sport I played when I grew up in the '80s, that's not something you ever get used to, never can excuse. Having said that, people mightn't say it without malice, but if you're on the receiving end of it, yeah, four or five times a game, every game of the season, it can be soul crushing. No, those excuses there was nothing meant by it, or it slipped out. I don't know how these things slip out, but in any case, they're not acceptable and we should not turn a blind eye to them.
Did it stop you wanting to play sport when you were growing up, Ian?
Not stop me, but I knew what I was in for. That was, yeah, you know, and the funny thing is, Rochelle, I mean, the same people who would get it ripping into you when you're playing be the first ones to shake your hand after a game and say, oh, geez, you played well, mate. Because that was the 80s, you know, it was the early to mid-1980s. I think for me, and the bit that makes me a little bit cross about it, this is 2026.
Yeah.
This is 40 years later and we're still doing this, you know. So I think this is an opportunity for us to, as a community, to look at ourselves and say, is this who we really are? Do we not want to be better than this? So it's an opportunity for ordinary people in their local sporting clubs to say, you know what, let's try and bring out the better part of ourselves by saying, here is where we stand on this issue and we do not accept that is just the normal state of events.
The idea that it's not about perfection, it's about progress, and I know that's something that you've said in the past, and I think that junior sport and local sport, it is actually the perfect place to create change. Sometimes the change doesn't happen at the top and trickle down. It happens at the bottom and it filters up. So this is a perfect place. And to have actual, I'm using the term guidelines, but is that the right term? Or is this more like a what would you call them? How would you refer to set the standard?
I'd call it a toolkit. So
toolkit, that's good, yeah.
Yeah, so there's stuff online to help people. There's videos, there's conversations, guides about how to do it. It's also about networking people who are dealing with the same issues so they can talk to each other about how are you dealing with this in your club, or is this an issue for our league or our competition? And bear in mind, this isn't just about a particular sport. It's about all sports. It's about, footy, cricket, netball. Just been watching the Winter Olympics. I don't know if Victoria has curling, but it would probably happen in curling too, you know? So this is about in all our sporting codes, no matter what it is, because sport is such an intrinsic part of how we define ourselves as Australians, as Victorians, which is why Vic Health has decided to put so much effort into producing this toolkit.
But just one last question. Ian Hamm's with you, Yorta Yorta Man and Vic Health Chair. Lots of training. If you put up your hand to coach basketball, netball, footy, there's lots of training that you have to do. There's lots of checks and balances that need to go in to place in order for you to be legally allowed to do that. Should something like this toolkit be a part of that training?
I think it should be an accessible tool, and I think it should be provided to people when they are willing to take on, you know, the very important roles of club volunteers, whether it's in administration or particularly with coaching and those type of things, so that they're prepared for what might come along. And we have to do all we can to support people do that, because volunteering now is much less prevalent than it used to be. Get the best out of our children, or even our older people, like senior football is the same, supporting coaches in that area too. It would be great that as part of the preparation for people going into coaches' role or continuing coaching education, my advice would be that, yes, this should be one of the things that people go to quite early in the piece so that they're ready and equipped for something that hopefully won't come up, but if it does, they'll at least know where to start and how to deal with it.
Lots of people behind the scenes putting this together. You must be really happy and proud of this toolkit, Ian. Is it something that you envisage will kind of change and morph as time goes on?
Oh, absolutely. So, and you're right, there's lots of people involved with it. So all the different sporting associations around Victoria have been part of this and the different sport peak bodies in Victoria. We've also engaged with local clubs. You're right though, Rochelle, it has to be of its time. It has to adapt to the times that it's in. So it will evolve and it will change over time. But nonetheless, it's something that you have to be we'll never get to the utopia where racism doesn't exist. The best we can do is minimise it, and when it does happen, respond to it and ensure that it doesn't take root and doesn't grow.
So this has been pulled together by Vic Health. You can go to setthestandard.vic.gov.au to be able to access it, to be able to use this toolkit. I guess my final question, Ian, and this is one without notice, but Vic Health, you know, and the future of Vic Health is up in the air, potentially going under a whole separate banner and not standing alone as its own entity. And yet you listen to the importance of something like Set the Standard and the work that you're doing. Yowzers. I mean, will this sort of stuff still happen in the future, do you think?
Oh, look, I think, as I said, look, racism, I think, will exist. There are many public health issues that will exist. Certainly as Vic Health, we focus on why we exist, and that's what we've been doing, forever and still do it now. So under the excellent leadership of Professor Anna Peters, the reason we exist is to promote the better health of all Victorians. That's what we're focusing on, and that's what we'll continue to do.
Thank you so much for your time and your insights, and thank you for your work in this space. It's really, really important. So people can go to setthestandard.vic.gov.au. Ian, thank you.
Always a pleasure, Rochelle.
See, Ian is the chair of Vic Health, Yorta Yorta Man. So if you're involved in a local soccer club, netball club, soccer, footy, you name it, and you want to read through this toolkit, these guidelines, the scenarios, if you want to watch the videos, if you want to get involved, maybe you just want to check whether or not you think your club might actually be subconsciously biased and racist as well, then it's setthestandard.vic.gov.au. Coming up next, what do you learn at kindergarten? Can you remember what you learned at kindergarten? Is it just about taking a nap and finger painting, cutting up fruit, or is it more than that? We know that kindergarten, that childhood educators are going on strike today. So what did you learn at kinder, and what are your children learning at kindergarten, and why is it important?
On 774 ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Rochelle Hunt.
So I don't know about you, but did you have your photograph taken at kindergarten? You know, maybe your nana had a copy and it was sitting up on the mantle. I can still see mine really, really clearly. I was about 4 years old. I was in an oversized Mission Brown art smock. I had a huge paintbrush. It was almost as big as my entire body, and I was painting something abstract on a huge wooden easel. And there is either something about that photograph or something kind of hidden in my memory where I have believed for my entire life that I just loved kindergarten. It might have had something to do with the fact that I played Mary in the Christmas pageant. I'm not sure. But I just loved kindergarten. But your kids' kindergarten may not be open today. And kindergarten teachers and early education teachers across the state are going on strike for better pay conditions. So what is your child learning at kinder? Is it important? Is it just about finger painting? And maybe that's okay. But is it more than that? 1-300-222-774. Dr. Corina Davis is the CEO of Early Learning Association. Corina, we know that early educators are on strike at the moment. Kindergarten teachers are on strike. When we think about kindergarten, do we just think about it as naps and fruit and sandpits?
Hi there, Rochelle. How are you? Thanks for having me on. And I will start by saying my picture in front of the easel was a mustard yellow. And I look back at that very fondly.
I know. And that must have been like the stock standard photograph for kinder, I think.
Yes, absolutely. Maybe we're the same generation.
I think we might be. I loved kinder. I lived across the road from my kindergarten. I can remember the gates. I can remember the room. I can remember where we sat for story time. And this was a long time ago, mind you. It can be the most incredible introduction to education. But we don't even, and maybe as kids we don't even see it as education.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of really good quality education, isn't it? That you're immersed in the interests and the growth and learning of young children. You are planning for their growth and learning across all sorts of domains, social and emotional health, language, academic concepts, physical skill. That is the great skill and capability of kindergartens across the state, where they are really specialist in both child growth and development as well as education. And they are looking at the growth and learning of the whole child. And then they focus their planning for learning across all of those levels in an environment where if you walked in and you were uninitiated, it looks like you've got a really settled group of children just playing. But that is so far from what the practice is and so far from what the expertise is. And so our kinder teachers and our kinder educators are doing all of that work. Kids are learning through inquiry. They learn that learning is great fun. It doesn't have to be tedious. And they're learning the really foundational concepts of academic skill for when they do go to school. And so, for example, you often know in kindergarten there's a block corner. And block corners are essential for mathematical learning, the foundational concepts. You learn over and under. You learn how high things will go and what it takes for them to topple down. When you're in front of a teacher reading a book, you're learning that those squiggly lines on a page represent a word. You're learning conceptual learning and abstract learning, which is so critical to the foundations of what comes next for children.
Even the skill of sitting down with other kids and being able to concentrate. That's,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, where you've got someone sitting next to you and you know that it's actually not time to play and to poke them or to have
and
a laugh.
Poke. Yep, and play that, yeah. And so when you walk into a kindergarten room at the beginning of a year and when you would go into that same kindergarten room at the end of the year, you're going to see very, very different things. And so what you're seeing at this time of year are kindergarten teachers and educators working really hard to help children feel safe and settled, to help them understand what the give and take of social relationships in groups are like, and really thinking about how do they build that skill up across a year. And so that learning is remarkable. What we do know about really good quality kindergarten provision is it gives double back for investment when a child is an adult. We see that good quality access to kindergarten provides stronger academic performance, higher school completion. And so all of that work that's done in the 3- and 4-year-old, particularly in Victoria, that has a policy approach now for 3-year-old and 4-year-old kinder, that children are learning and the skill and expertise of the adults in that room who are
helping. Oh, it's unbelievable to witness.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, they're also toilet training and doing all sorts of things. Karina, stay with us. And those little toilets, oh my goodness, don't they just break your heart? Oh, that's so sweet. Dr. Karina Davis is with you, CEO of Early Learning Association. Your child's kindergarten may be closed today as many of the early educators are going on strike for better pay. But we're talking about what did you learn at kindergarten? What do your children learn at kindergarten? What do your grandchildren learn at kindergarten? Ali's in Geelong. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. How are you?
Good. What did you want to share?
So I just wanted to share, I have a son that started prep this year. He has special needs, so he's autistic and nonverbal. And kinder was just so huge for him and our family to teach him those fundamental skills that have helped that school transition. So I had a meeting with his school yesterday and they said he was doing amazingly well. He's sitting at a table to eat, he's sitting at his desk to learn, he's lining up when the music goes at the end of playtime. And I just know we would not have been able to do that at home.
Yeah. Wow. Has that changed your life at home, Ali? Like looking at now the skills your son has got at home?
It absolutely has. And we were just so fortunate with our beautiful kinder, how amazing they were and his teacher had for 3 years. They toilet trained him.
Yeah.
We could not get him toilet trained at home and they just did it. And then it's taken all of summer to get him to do it at home. But for us as a family, we could not have functioned without that.
Ali, I'm so glad to hear that. I'm great that you've had a really good experience. 1-300-222-774. Maybe you've had a similar experience. Ali, if you're a kindergarten teacher yourself, we're going to have a chat to one in just a moment. But Dr. Karina Davis is with you, CEO of Early Learning Association. Karina, what is the difference between kindergartens? There's all different types of kindergartens. You know, Bob and Chanel had a caller this morning talking about a kinder that's only, you know, a couple of days a week, only a couple of hours at a time. Then there was a response to that that basically said, well, you need, you know, long daycare. My daughter went to a daycare kindergarten because I worked full time. So is there a difference between, I want to call it childcare kindergarten and state kindergarten or government kindergarten?
Look, I think we have a really diverse provision across the state and across the nation, but across the state. Kindergarten is often seen as the period between 3 and 5 years for children. And kindergarten can run now, because we've got such complex needs in our communities and society, and we need education for children in particular ways. So we have what is historically the sessional kindergartens that used to run. They might run for short periods of time, really, really nestled in the community and been there for years and years with dedicated staff teams that have been there. They're just completely part of their community. We have those ones. We have some of those ones run by parent volunteer committees of management, and they are deeply invested in their communities and ensuring that that kindergarten stayed like that. We have kindergartens that run for full days now to meet the needs of the family members in their communities. They might be run by early years management organisations, and we also have kindergarten that runs in centre-based care. And so that funded as part of a national funding and policy regime, and then you have kinder provision by a kindergarten teacher within the day that children are there. And so what's really wonderful about how kindergarten has moved and shifted is it's responded to the needs of contemporary current families, but held on to the real impetus of the education for children in that space, and how do we bring in a deeply qualified teacher workforce and educators who are also so beautifully qualified to do that education work as well as the care.
And that's what's changed even in how we refer to, you know, a kindergarten teacher versus an early education specialist or teacher, and the work and the study that goes into it. This is a message that's come through from Jack, and it says, my girlfriend is a kinder teacher. She went without for years as a mum of three to get her master's in teaching. She's now been qualified for 4 years, has worked full-time in the field with countless unpaid hours of planning and organising classes because she's just so passionate about early childhood education. She has 16 kids out of her class of 24 with special needs and can tell me individual learning strategies for each of those children to ensure that they're engaged, eager learners and will thrive at school. She rents a small house on the Mornington Peninsula whilst living frugally, will never be able to save for a house of her own. She is way more valuable to our society than any CEO. Oh, Jack, what a lovely message.
Isn't that wonderful?
Isn't that great?
Jack.
I know. Thank you, Jack. Karina, stay with us because I want to have a chat to Stella, who is an early education teacher herself. Stella, a warm welcome. What does your day look like when you're at kindergarten, when you walk in and you've got 24 kids or whatever it may be? What does your day look like?
Hi, Rochelle. Hi, everyone. Jack's letter almost made me cry when I was hearing him. It's like echoed a lot with myself. So I'm currently in a three-year-old kinder room this year at a not-for-profit community-based center. So for our kinder room, every day we're expecting 27 children, with full of the beautiful educators. So I would say like the day is full of play, exploration, conversation, relationships. So like in the morning before I came to get your phone call, they were like building the blocks, and some were reading a story with one of our teachers, and outside they were climbing on the monkey bars, chatting with each other on the seesaw, and of course some children were fighting over the bikes. So a lot of like the learning and the teaching moments happen in the spontaneous play.
Yeah, it really does, doesn't it? And that might be, my daughter went through a phase of hiding her favourite toy so that when she got there, only she could play with it. And I was like, oh my goodness, this is a learning moment. And the teachers were incredible. They were like, you know what, you can't do that. This toy is for everybody. So they're the teachable moments, aren't they?
Yes, and just as like Karina said, there's a lot of the things like when they look like they're just playing, but there's a lot of learning and teaching happening. And some of the skills that we have to find the moments to go in and support them, we have to be emotional available all day. So I would say like this profession needs a lot of passion and like real love for children. Because I do find like throughout the day, we have to like keep talking with the children and find different ways to talk through with them and supporting them and trying to help with, you know, conflict resolution or help themselves to solve a problem.
What do you love about what you do, Stella?
I do love what I'm doing because I feel like the early learning is so powerful. The first 5 years, they're just like when the brain develops most rapidly. Because when I was in kinder, I had such a wonderful teacher. She was just always so kind and nurturing. And I think that's like, you know, having a seed in myself, like I want to be a teacher like her. And now I'm a mom of like myself as well. And I really know how important, like, you know, having the quality early years can shape the children to see who they are and who, like, who the world, like, you know, who's around them in the world. And I do feel like when they feel like, you know, safe and supported, they become someone really confident and that they carry on for like so many years in their life.
I was always amazed when early education teachers would then go home to small children. And I'd be thinking, oh, my God, oh my God. How do you do this? You must be exhausted at the end of the day, Stella.
Well, to be honest, I am exhausted, but then, like, I have to switch myself. So when I finish work, I give myself 5 minutes, and then I tell myself, okay, now I'm switching from a teacher to a mummy. And then I'm going to pick up him from my center. So I greet him and ask him how his day been. I'll just try to leave whatever's behind for the day, and I'll start fresh with him because I know he's missed me as well. So I'm trying to give him quality time as much as I can after I finish work.
Oh, Stella, thank you for the work that you do. Really, honestly, I don't know how you guys do it. It's incredible. Thank you, Stella. Dr. Karina Davis, CEO of Early Learning Association today. Are you confident today that the strikes will create any pay change?
I think that it's really important that we stress the skill, expertise and the love that our kinder teachers have out in the community, and really highlight, Rochelle, the increasing complexity that our kindergartens and the professionals within them are working towards. And so the more that we can highlight that, the more that we can highlight their value to community, the more that together we can advocate for what is a fair wage and conditions deal that values the professionalism and skill of this workforce, then we've got our fingers tightly crossed for a really positive outcome.
Karina, thank you. The memories have been beautiful. I'm really taken back to Contingent Street, Trafalgar. Thank you. Karina Davis, the CEO of Early Learning Association. Pam's in Castlemaine. Hi, Pam.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. What did you want to share?
I just wanted to give a perspective as a parent of kids who were in kinder decades ago now, 30, 40 years ago. Mm. But one of the things that I really noticed was the value for me as a parent in two ways. One was that the kinder really provided me with a social network. So I met other parents through the preschool, and the preschool educators were actually active in helping to set up opportunities for us to meet each other and then go out and form connections. So that was quite valuable to me meeting other people in my local community. The other thing that I noticed was that the teachers were really liaising with the kids, I guess, in the context of the family. So if there was a child that was struggling, was maybe grieving the loss of a grandparent, yeah, or had issues at home, or was having issues with refusal to come to kinder, mm, the teachers were really working hard with the parent as well as with the child. And I think we learned a lot from what we learned from the teachers as parents ourselves.
And depending on your circumstance, I remember, Pam, when my daughter went into childcare, I felt like I had help for the first time. Like if you, because yeah, I don't have grandparents and mama died, you know, lots of people are in a circumstance where their parents are overseas, or it's just assumed that you have this village. Not everyone has the village, you know, especially if you're later or earlier having kids. Maybe all of your friends don't have children or have got children that are grown up. You don't have this instant crew around you to help, to ask questions of, to a shoulder to lean on. And all of a sudden you have these professionals who know what to do. And I can remember just bursting into tears thinking, oh my God, I've got some help.
Yeah. And I think it's educated help too. So you get lots of messages from all over the place telling you what you should or shouldn't do as a parent. And I think that the preschool educators are a really valuable source of informed information and support.
Yeah, absolutely. Pam, thank you. Rob's in Ringwood. Good morning, Rob.
Hi, how are you going?
Really good. What do you want to share?
My two children went to Montessori kinder. Now, that was quite structured. I can remember one thing in particular. It was something called Cuisenaire sticks, and they were units and double units, different colours. So it was numbering systems up to 10 decimals. And I was the only dad usually, so I ended up being the maintenance officer. But I do remember that Montessori was quite structured in its approach to helping the children learn. It was quite different, I think, to other kindergarten systems.
Yeah. And I think whether it be depending on where you grew up, and the era that we grew up in and how kindergarten has changed as well, Rob. Rob, thank you. Keep those calls coming in. What do you remember about kindergarten? What did you learn at kindergarten? And what is the skill that you witnessed your child bring home from kindergarten that really helped you? Is it sitting still? Is it eating something that previously they wouldn't eat, like eating your veggies or, I don't know, eating the crusts on bread? Was it toilet training? You know, what helped? What skill did they learn that in theory isn't education, but it's all about education and helping them just be able to socially interact with others, to be able to take that moment, maybe to not have a nap in the middle of the day, to be able to push on through and to be able to manage your emotions.
On 774 ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Rochelle Hunt.
Ay, Titi me preguntó si tengo muchas novias, hoy tengo a una, mañana otra, ay, pero no hay boda, Titi me preguntó.
So do you listen to music in a language other than English? Maybe you spend time with your parents and they listen to music from their homeland. And how does music help you stay connected to your culture and to your heritage? That you're listening to now is Bad Bunny. He is playing a series of concerts in Sydney this weekend. You might have heard of Bad Bunny by now. He was the first Spanish language artist to win Album of the Year at this year's Grammys. He performed at the Super Bowl. And there are people lining up to go and see his concerts this weekend. His sixth studio album. Now, I'm going to completely butcher this, but it's called Debri Tria Mas Fotos, which translates to I should have taken more photos. And that taps into cultural identity and connection to homeland. So is this why he is connecting with so many Australians locally? If you listen to music in a language other than English, if you listen to Bad Bunny, what makes you connect to him. And did you see him arrive at the Sydney airport today? Well, one woman who did, because she was there and rocked up to the Sydney airport today, is Michelle Olivares, who runs the social media page celebrating all things Hispanic music. Michelle, did you make it to the airport this morning?
I actually didn't make it to the airport, but what happened was there was a lot of people from the Latin Australian community who were there, and I have a social media presence. My page is called Amiga Mia, and a lovely Latin Australian called Daniel reached out to me via socials, and he said, "I'm here at the airport. There's a couple of us here. I've got front row seats, and I'm recording Benito, who's Bad Bunny's real name, and his crew arriving." And then he said, "I'm happy to give you, like, you know, minute updates on what's happening, and so you can share it with the wider audience and for the community." And I said, "Yes, please." And so the minute he came out, he recorded that footage, and then we posted it online so everyone could celebrate that moment.
Were there many people there?
Yeah, apparently not that many. It was definitely crowded. So he said probably about 30 people.
Okay, that's not bad.
But it was the noise of about, you know, 300.
The idea of his latest album, which translates to "I should have taken more photos" and sort of tapping into cultural identity. There are many people who are listening to Bad Bunny who don't even know what he's singing, that don't know or cannot translate the lyrics, yet for some reason connect. What does that, and this is sort of a big question, Michelle, but what does that tell us about, I guess, the importance of music and cultural connection and how music can really tap into our ancestors, to our story, to our homeland, to our parents and to our grandparents?
I think it's a great question. And I talking about my own personal experience here, so I'm the first in Australia. I'm born in Australia, my family, and my parents are both Chilean, so Latino migrants. And so I kind of grew up with this dual identity of speaking Spanish at home and being culturally Chilean, but then also adopting Aussie values and speaking English with wider society, right? And so seeing an artist like Bad Bunny, and he's, you know, won a Grammy, and he's, you know, did the Super Bowl halftime show all in Spanish. For us, it's representation, it's feeling seen, it's seeing someone with a shared lived experience that's on such a global stage. To be visiting Australia is such a big deal. And again, coming back to representation, but then he's actually transcending past the Latin and Spanish speaking communities. I've got a bunch of friends who don't speak a word of Spanish, and they're going to both of the shows.
I love that.
Because of his message that he communicates, yeah. It's not just about preserving culture, but it's also about preserving memory. To your point earlier about his album, Dividir Más Fotos, it's all about, you know, balancing being in the moment with friends and family and loved ones, but equally, like, don't forget to take that photo, because when you get a little bit older and maybe you don't have the opportunity to be in those moments, that's what you reflect back on, is these beautiful memories.
I've one of my best friends is Greek, and when I watch him with his mum listening to Greek music, I see something different. You know, I see a side of him, a connection and a culture that I'm so jealous of, that I don't have. And it's a way too of preserving your heritage and your history, and listening to that music and how it makes you feel.
Absolutely. And what he's done a really great job with this new album is being able to speak about his connection to Puerto Rico, you know, his homeland, and he's really being a voice to it and speaking about preserving everything that makes that culture beautiful to him and sharing it with the world. And that's what's so beautiful to see, that everyone who's, you know, listening to his music or going to visit his shows or following his story, not only do they get to know more about him as an artist and the message that he's communicating and his sound and all of that sort of stuff, but equally they're learning more about Puerto Rico and the heritage and the culture and the way of life there. And it's such a beautiful thing to see.
Well, we start to see more artists recording in their parents' language, in their homeland language, in their native tongue, you know, whether it be Marlon Williams, I know in one of his albums as a Maori man, sung in Maori, whether it be Indigenous artists singing in their language. Will Bad Bunny almost give a tick of approval for artists to say, actually, you know what, I don't need to translate this to English?
And I think a really great point to add to that, yes, and I completely agree with you, is that he did an official collaboration with Adidas and merch dropped not long ago. And on the actual shirt, it has the album cover name, but it also has the word Sydney, but it's written in Spanish.
Mm.
And so for some, you could look at that as it's a quirk, as a fun quirk. But for a lot of people, especially in the Spanish-speaking community, that was a statement and that was noticed, that it was unapologetically honouring his roots and his language. And people from all walks of life are embracing that.
That really transcended to so many different cultures. It was quite emotional watching his dance and interpretation and the story being told, not just through his music, but physically through his performance and storytelling on stage during the Super Bowl. I can only imagine, Michelle, it would have been emotional for you to watch in some way.
It was. I saw it firsthand at the Live Nation watch party, and I was really grateful to be there amongst so many, you know, people in the music industry. But then I saw it again at home, and that's when I cried. Because you start to notice all the cultural nuances, like La Casita. So if people going to the show and you keep seeing this sort of pink and colourful house there, that's a sort of quintessential Puerto Rican house. And he's bringing a piece of Puerto Rico to the concerts and he's taking it throughout his tour. Even down to having, you know, wearing the Puerto Rican straw hat, that's a cultural piece as well. And so you're absolutely, it sort of takes you on this journey through Puerto Rico and he brings you along to enjoy it and learn more about it. And that's what you saw at the halftime show as well. Like just one example being the kid sleeping on the chairs, you know, that's such a cultural moment for so many people in the Latin community. And when we saw that, we were like, oh my goodness, like this is goes well beyond a musical performance. This is a cultural piece. And we loved it.
Are you going on the weekend, Michelle?
I'm going to both.
It will be the most wild, incredible experience. I could only imagine what it's going to be like there. Michelle, thank you. Some lovely texts coming in, just things like, I cannot believe that people don't listen to international music and only restrict themselves to music from about 4 out of 170-odd countries. You don't necessarily need to be able to understand what they're saying. A voice is an instrument like any other. Latin, Middle Eastern, European, Caribbean, the lot, says Zach. And another that says, people have been listening to music in languages other than their own for hundreds of years. It's called opera, but that's a good example as well. Michelle, thank you so much for your time and I wish you all the best on the weekend. Have fun.
Thank you so much.
Michelle Yanez Oliveras, who runs the social media page celebrating Hispanic music. If you listen to music in languages other than English, 1-300-222-774. We've been talking today about kindergarten and what you learnt at kindergarten, whether or not you loved going to kindergarten. We know that early educators are on strike today. Alastair's called through. Hello, Alastair.
Hey, how you going?
Good. Kinder was important to you, wasn't it?
Yeah, so, you know, you're talking about photos and memories of childcare or kinder. And, I met my wife, or my current wife, when I was four. We were both four then. And we're both, she just turned 40 last week. So, yeah.
You met your wife at kindy.
Yep. And it's, had a period in between of not knowing each other when we were in primary school, but yeah.
So when did you reconnect? And how, like, did you know straight away that you went to kindergarten together?
Yeah, so our parents worked together when we were in kinder, and then randomly enough, when we were in high school, our friends, all from different schools and different walks of life, somehow knew each other, and then ended up going to a house party as you do in teenage years. And
wow, have you still got the photo? Have you got the kinder photo of the two of you?
Yeah So on her 40th and my 40th last year, we both it was one of our photos on the invite, and we had the photos at our wedding and all that sort of stuff. So it's
cute.
Very, very, very important period of time, I suppose.
Meant to be, hey? What was your outfit like? Yeah, you know, your kindergarten outfits, you're always like, whoa, what did mum put me in?
I think my grandma had knitted me a multicoloured woolen jumper.
What is it? That's the uniform of kindergarten, some really weird knitted jumper.
I think it's just because you go through them so quickly and it's like whatever your parents can get for next to nothing because you just ruin it straight away.
Absolutely. Oh, I love that story, Alistair. Thank you. Let's quickly end with Sue Ellen, who's in Seaspray. Good morning.
Good morning.
What did you want to say?
I'm a local kindergarten teacher at a small rural kindergarten in Longford. So our kindergarten's actually, we're not a town, we're a community. So our kinder's been there for 44 years and just part of the community hub. So we, the community's part of a lot of what we do in our programming. So we have that really great community connection. And we also, we have a lot of children that come in from outlying areas. So we sort of cater for a many, sort of all the little outlying areas that surround Longford. So.
And in regional areas, it's even more important to have somewhere to go, to have that access, to be able to connect with people. What keeps you in the profession, Sue Ellen?
I just love what I do. I love working as a kinder teacher. I love, you know, educating the children and sort of, you know, giving them a foothold into life and where they may go, you know, further on. And I've been doing it for many years, so I'm close to retirement. So, we have a great team. We've been there together for a long time and we have a great, you know, parents are wonderful. So we have, it's a really great kindergarten for that parent community connection. So,
Ellen, thank you. I don't know. I mean, you guys have just got this skill where you can get our kids to do things that we just can't, and I don't know where we'd be without you. Sue Ellen, thank you. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care, and we'll speak to you soon.